From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Ah, thank you very much, Simon. Well, it's wet, it's dull, it's grim, it's Salford. It's a Thursday afternoon. I'm Richie Allen. Got a really good show for you today, and thanks for joining me as usual.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Welcome, one and all. Welcome, one and all. Yes, the last live show of the week. Tis myself. I'm joined today by the documentary filmmaker Richard Willett. Richard has been on the program in the past, but not the recent past. He also is producing videos these days for the iconic platform, glitchinthecode.com, a podcast host as well. And he's got some interesting opinions, does Richard? Rick, we call him. He joins me in about a half an hour's time, and I know you'll join in on Twitter, as is the style of the time. Do join in on Twitter. Yes, indeedy. Yeah, there is no summer, is there? Is there? I don't. Maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it's a good thing. I don't know. But today was pretty bad, pretty miserable today. Didn't start off too bad. But I'm looking out the studio window now, and well, not even Michael Lowry. Oh, Richie, I know, Michael, right, okay. Richard Willett in a half an hour, we'll round the news up before that. As a football fan, shocking to see Liverpool in an empty stadium last night, receiving the Premier League trophy. Did you see it? It's pure vaudeville. Not a fan in the stadium, which I think holds well in excess of 50,000 people. Nobody there. The fans were outside with their cans of Stella and Budweiser and McEwen's, getting pissed up having a sing-song. Thousands of them. It's madness. The same thing was going on in outside the West Bromwich Albion Stadium. Do you know what's happening to me? I'm developing Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. Oh, the Hawthorns, that's it. I had to think about that. And Elland Road, because Leeds won the championship and West Brom finally came second in the championship. And they're going to be in the Premier League. So you have fans hugging each other, crying like grown men do, like Muppets do, because we are Muppets. We're morons. It's bread and circuses. We know, but we love it. We love our sport, and it just, I don't know, it helps make the week worthwhile, really. And yes, you had Jurgen Klopp and the Liverpool players. Great city, Liverpool. I hate their football team. I have a Ouija board here, and I have these things you stick pins in. What are they called? I told you I've got Alzheimer's. What are they called? These things, when you want to kill somebody, you put one of their hairs on a little doll and you stab the doll. Voodoo doll, is that it? Yeah, love Liverpool, hate Liverpool Football Club. I don't hate them anymore. I did when I was a kid. So there you have them. They're in the stadium with fireworks that only they can see. The fans are outside. And I thought, ironically, I thought, now the players understand, or they remember what it was like to be a child. Because when I was a child, I used to fantasize in my living room when nobody was looking. I had these little... My father worked at Waterford Crystal, so I had these vases. And I would pretend the vase was the Liam McCarthy Cup, which is won by the All-Ireland winning hurling team. Or I would pretend it was the FA Cup as a five-year-old when nobody was looking. Alan raises the Liam McCarthy Cup. And then one day I was caught. I was caught by my Uncle Ger, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm lifting the Liam McCarthy Cup. That's how you do it for Waterford." And Ger said, "That's not the way you do it. You have to do it that way so that the Queen can see it." And I said, "We don't have a Queen." And he said, "We fucking will by the time Waterford win the All-Ireland." Boom, boom, boom. That's a very old gag. So there they were, Leeds fans, West Brom fans, Liverpool fans, outside, pissed right up, and the players were celebrating in an empty stadium. Madness. And tomorrow, in the middle of summer, when people's immune systems are at their most robust, they want us to wear masks in shops. And thanks to Simon Dolan, thank you, Simon, for alerting me to this. This happened on Tuesday. The Chief Medical Officer, Chris Whitty, appeared before a parliamentary committee, which means he was facing MPs' questions. These things are so boring, and I don't have any help here, that you miss things. I miss things, right? Witty, Chris Witty, in response to a question from former Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt, Chris Witty said this and gives the game away. Woohoo!
And to be clear, multiple steps were taken along the way. And if you look at the R and the behaviours, quite a lot of the change that led to the R going below one occurred in well before, or to some extent before, the 23rd when the full lockdown started. Now, that's not to be clear, I'm very much in favour of the fact the lockdown happened, but actually some people argue that R had crossed one even before that point in time. Lots of people are going over the numbers retrospectively, and it's very easy to do that retrospectively. But I think I just wanted to clarify that that was what Patrick said and meant.
Yeah. And of course, Jeremy Hunt, because he isn't a journalist, to give him a little bit of credit, he didn't follow up on this.
Quite a lot of the change that led to the R going below one occurred in well before, or to some extent before, the 23rd when the full lockdown started.
Yes, the R number. Cases were disappearing before we started the lockdown. I mean, that's worth following up on, eh? So before we imposed the lockdown in mid-March, well, the virus was kind of going away. It was retreating, he said later on. So why the lockdown then? This is bombshell. They knew that the virus was feck-all really and was on the wane before the lockdown. They knew it and still they imposed the lockdown. This is really important. What the hell can we do with information like this? What can we do with it?
Enjoy yourself and kill a granny is the answer.
Just kill a granny. Bludgeon a granny to death and get on with it. And accept that life as we understand it is gone, is what we're going to have to do. I'll find reasons for 5 more years. I'll find reasons to use that clip. Thanks to Aaron for reminding me Voodoo Doll. And it has occurred to me, this summer, I gave up using my Liverpool Voodoo Doll, which I used to use at the start of every season. I had my Liverpool Doll, Voodoo Doll, with the hairs of former players, and I would stick it with pins, and Liverpool didn't win the league. I remember back in 2014, around about April, I can't remember, I think it was April, I had a little Steven Gerrard doll, and I put tiny roller skates on it. And, well, you know the rest. Professor Robert Dingwall of the New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group. What the hell is that? Robert Dingwall of the New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group, or NERVTAG. It's called NERVTAG for short. What are we going to do? Call NERVTAG. Yes, and a geeky scientist will turn up. NERVTAG advises the government, and I want you to listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you now, because this is important. They do, this is the feckin' thing. They do have advisors, and have had them from day one. Advisors who have said, this is a stinking pile of horse manure, or words to that effect. But they haven't been listening to those advisors. Okay? They've only been listening to Gates's henchmen, that's Billy Poisonjabs. Billy Poisonjabs, his henchmen, Chris Witty, whom we've heard from, and Patrick Vallance, are shouting down the other scientists who have said, this is a load of balls. Right? Right. Anyway. Let's get on to Robert Dingwall. Dingwall, who 1 month ago, said that the 2 metre social distancing was a nonsense. No scientific basis in it, he said. He told Radio 4 this. I played the clip at the time. Today, he was on Sky News, talking with Isabel, whatever her surname is, I can't remember. And he was talking about masks, which are all the rage and will be all the rage tomorrow. You will hear the presenter asking him the question. You will hear his answer.
I want to ask you about the choice of the word premature. You've argued that calls to wear them are premature, and I just wonder if you think, therefore, there will come a time, a better time, when they might be necessary.
It's very hard to see when that time would be. I mean, to some extent, we're suffering, I think, from the continuing lack of clarity in the government's position by, I suppose, the sort of incremental nature of the policy. We're not, for example, getting a clear message that there is no reason to wear masks in any outdoor public setting. The the risk of transmission there is somewhere between negligible to non-existent. There are a limited number of situations, as I think the CMO for Wales is recognising, where there may be some benefit where people are being forced into close proximity for extended periods of time. But in between that, I think the view that many of us would take is that face covering should be a matter of choice rather than a matter of compulsion, that in the absence of robust scientific evidence, it's really just not appropriate for the government to enforce this. I mean, having said that, of course, if there's a law, I shall join with others in obeying it. But that doesn't mean to say that I think it's an appropriate or legitimate law.
Well, don't obey illegitimate laws then, Professor. Don't do that. So Webster, the presenter, says, well, you heard what he said, by the way. I won't replay it because I don't have time. You heard what he said. The evidence to support the wearing of masks as a good thing is negligible or non-existent. There is none. This is tyranny. And it's about time people realised it. So the presenter says, in response to what he just said, she says, well, the government reckons there might be some small advantage to wearing them, and better than nothing, eh? And wearing them will give us all the courage to re-emerge blinking in the summer sun to shop the bejesus out of the high streets. We'll have the courage to go out, says the presenter. Robert Dingwall?
Well, that's a question that many of my friends in psychology and other sociologists would question.
I like this guy. He sounds like one of the eggheads. You know, a know-all. Sometimes know-alls are not very pleasant. This is a good know-all. He's now saying that his mates in psychology are looking into this wearing of masks. And what he says now is very interesting.
In psychology and other sociologists would question the extent to which mask wearing, in fact, promotes a message of fear and anxiety.
Yes.
And it is, in that sense, counterproductive. I think it is equally plausible, and there is equally good evidence to suppose that the pervasive covering of faces will actually increase fear and make people more reluctant to go out into the world and to achieve the objective of restoring something like normal social and economic life.
Well said, Robert Dingwall. And just to piss you off even more, this guy and his group are advising the UK government. This is the Sickener, his group Nerve Tag. Yeah, the new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group. And he's been saying to the government from day one, no big deal really. Social distancing, load of bollocks. Masks, load of bollocks as well. Just get on with it. Herd immunity, natural. It's already happened. Don't forget, this is the chief scientific advisor to the government, the chief medical officer. Chris Whitty, listen again.
Quite a lot of the change that led to the R going below one occurred in well before, or to some extent before, the 23rd when the full lockdown started.
Yes, and there were no changes before the lockdown. The lockdown came out of the blue. The R number was going backwards. Just in case you don't know what the R number is. The R number is the expected number of people that could be infected by a single infected person. So if I had the coronavirus, right, and I was likely to infect two people in my locality, the R number here would be two. The R number has been minus one forever and a day. Nobody has this fucking thing. I'm sorry for swearing. I promised Auntie Jean Ann this morning that I was past the swearing. Nobody has it. The vast majority of people who died from it died inside care homes. They were exterminated. Listen to Dr. Vernon Coleman. Go to the old man in the chair video blog on YouTube. He's brilliant. Listen to my interviews with him. They took people from hospitals, didn't test them, stuffed them in care homes, killed a lot of people by the looks of it. But everybody else gets it, and most of the time you don't even know you had it. It's tyranny. That's what it is. It's tyranny. My aforementioned pal in Cleggan has been saying from day one, the virus is the excuse for what's happening. That which they always wanted to do, to lock us down, right? Not just into our houses, but lock us down into a mindset where we accept surveillance, we accept health passports, we accept the necessity of a toxic tidal wave of puss and shit injected into your arm, or you don't go and have your everyday normal life. You don't go to school, college, work. You don't go to your social life. No. Virus is the excuse. There is no debate now. Facts trump your feelings. I see some of the comments underneath some of my tweets today from people screaming that I'm being irresponsible. Fake off. Facts trump your feelings, you dimwit. You have more chance of being killed by a piano falling from the sky that is being played by an ostrich sitting on a stool in front of it than you have of even, I would say, of even catching the virus at this stage. Let's move on. 19 minutes past the hour. The Russia bashing is fantastic on UK television news. It really is. The other morning, I was wondering why Marina Litvinenko was on Sky with the Ginger Ninja herself, our K. In fact, I arrived in the room as the interview was winding up, and I didn't bother rewinding it. I just assumed Russia bashing. It turned out there's an opera about the death of Alexander Litvinenko, who, when he died in 2006, was an author, but he is, of course, a former Russian FSB agent. He was allegedly poisoned with polonium, and there's an opera ready to go about his death, his murder. Wow. If that Catherine Jenkins is in it, I might consider it. But if she isn't, no chance. Anyway, that's what she was on talking about. So he blamed Putin on his deathbed. Putin says, hey, 'twasn't me. I was riding a donkey in Siberia bare-chested at the time with my woman behind me. Anywho, this is 14, 15 years ago. So his widow was on McKay Birdy the other morning. And then, this afternoon, I came across this while I was preparing this show. This is taken from live Sky News programme this afternoon.
Time now to tell you about a new podcast from Sky News called Polonium and the Piano Player, which explores the assassination...
Polonium and the Piano Player.
Cast from Sky News called Polonium and the Piano Player, which explores the assassination in 2006 of the former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko at a London hotel. Not only did the attack fatally poison Litvinenko, it also sucked the hotel's piano player Derek Conlon into a world of espionage and murder. It's available to listen on the Sky News app, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or indeed wherever you choose to get your podcasts from.
Christ
almighty. You're watching Sky News today, coming up.
Yeah, you're watching Sky News today. Then she goes on. And they ran this ad all day. Polonium and the Piano Player. Fantastic. Sky's head of programmes, I don't know his name, has to be a man. Has to be a man. Women are useless. Shut up. Shut up. The way things are going in a few months' time, Sky's head of programmes, and the BBC's, by the way, with equality laws, will be a wheelchair-bound blind lesbian dwarf from a poor family. Do you see that today? They want the BBC to have more poor people working for them. Now, I live in Salford. The BBC is based at, well, not entirely based, but largely based at Media City in Salford. And the BBC has committed to getting more poor people in on... It doesn't matter if they're qualified or not. Or if they've ever read a fucking newspaper. It doesn't matter. Wander around the streets there now. And look at people, and if you think somebody is broke, is absolutely fucked, nothing, nada, well, bring them in and give them a job producing BBC Breakfast. This is the truth. That diversity, I'm telling you, in the near future, you will be seeing on your television, not just producers, but presenters, wheelchair-bound blind lesbian dwarves from poor families. It's mental. Right, so anyway. So you can imagine the production meetings going on, headed by Sky's production guy, let's call him Dickie Black, we'll call him Dickie Black. So you have the guy sitting down with the presenters, and he's like, right guys, they always speak like that, don't they? Absolute arseholes. Right guys, it's Russia bashing next week, Russia bashing. Any ideas? Adam Bolton, no. Bunter, no. Kay, any ideas, Kay? And Kay says, yes, Dickie, let's get Marina Litvinenko back on the programme. And Dickie says, oh, come on, Kay, we've squeezed the bejesus out of that over the years. Really? Yeah, I'll interview her again. Get her on. Think of the pathos. It's Russia bashing morning, noon and night. The Russians interfering in elections, interfering in referenda and all the rest of it. And of course, more importantly, as I posted on Facebook the other day, they are increasingly blaming the Russians for any anti-vaccine talk or any 5G scepticism. They're trying to blame that on the Russians as well. It's mental. Very good stuff, this. Yeah. 23 and a half minutes past the hour. Mad. Women are not useless. I'm only joking. I'm only joking. They're not useless. I can think of two good uses for a woman. Now, moving on. I was told by my demographics manager, I've not been doing enough for my middle-aged, balding, misogynistic, racist listener. So I'm going to add a little bit of that in from time to time, if you don't mind. I was reporting yesterday on the news that Labour capitulated and paid off former employees. Remember this? Seven former employees from Labour's governance and legal unit who contributed to a BBC Panorama programme sued the party after the party issued a press release at the time describing these seven people as having personal and political access to grind. The Panorama programme was a hit job on Jeremy Corbyn, saying basically that, well, anti-Semitism was everywhere. We've had hundreds of complaints. And the programme alleged that Labour's leaders were interfering in the disciplinary process and letting anti-Semites off the hook. It's bullshit, obviously. But Labour apologised and settled financially. Jeremy Corbyn yesterday wasn't happy about it. Ian Collins, the presenter, was pontificating on this today on his show. And Naomi from London. Naomi, obviously from the west of London. Naomi rang in. She's a Labour Party member. And she schooled him. This is very, very good.
No, but what you're not recognising, Naomi, I believe, is that, firstly,
you're
Jeremy
going to tell
Corbyn...
me I don't understand anti-Semitism. That was so patronising.
No, I wasn't going to
Jeremy
tell you
Corbyn
that.
Jeremy Corbyn doesn't know what anti-Semitism is. Come on.
Well, he clearly doesn't, Naomi, because he has.
Yes, he
because
does.
He's from that wing of the party. He's from that. He's from that wing of the party, Naomi. You know that.
Tell me right now what anti-Semitism is.
I just explained to you. I explained in the point that you picked up on from the previous caller that the green light to have a pop at Israel has descended into this kind of sewer. That
no, but any
is what do you
you're
want it in its
some people might misuse
okay
their in its ability to Israel. It's a different thing. What is anti-Semitism?
Okay, in its rawest form, in its most basic form, discrimination against Jewish people.
Yes, right. So if somebody says, I disagree with the argument about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party because
yes.
I don't. All the allegations about supporting Palestine, which many of them are, though many of the allegations are to do with support for Palestine, I don't believe that those are anti-Semitic. You will get suspended from the Labour Party for saying that now. That is now defined.
Are you sure you'll get suspended for saying that?
Yes, because people have been.
What, because you have a disagreement with the Israeli front bench?
Israeli front bench.
Yes, if you say something against...
He's all over the place now. He's getting schooled by Naomi.
Say something...
The Israeli front bench? What the hell is he talking about?
...thing against Israel, you will... Are you saying that would get you suspended?
No, and she schools him. This is what was happening. The stuff being said by Labour Party members, which was deemed to be anti-Semitic and which was reported, wasn't anti-Jewish stuff... or ugly stereotypes about Jews. It was very, very strong criticism of Israel. She schools him.
No, it's worse than that.
It's worse.
If you suggest that somebody has been suspended or expelled because of their support for Palestinians and that what they said was not anti-Semitic, you can get suspended for suggesting that somebody
else...
You
can get suspended. Yeah, there'd be more to... I'd like to... Look, if somebody is suspended for that, then that's clearly ridiculous. I wouldn't support that.
Happening all the time.
But we know that your party is in the gutter, Naomi, on this. You must know that.
Because of the allegations.
You must know that.
Because of the mass of false... There are some true allegations. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds.
unfortunately, there are too many allegations and too much of an intrinsic link.
False allegations.
Well, maybe
you pick your favourite allegation, and I'll unpick it for you.
You want to
pick my one against Cork?
Well done, Naomi. You give me your favourite allegation. She said, and I'll unpick it for you. Vast majority of people were saying things like Zionism is the equal of Nazism, right? Now, I know that some Jews listening to this programme or others, they might not like that, and they might have a cogent argument prepared to dispute that, fair enough. But that's what the activists meant. They compared Gaza to concentration camps, and they, as I said before, importantly compared the conduct of the IDF in Israel to the conduct of the SS in Germany. And a lot of these complaints that were labelled as anti-Semitic were those type of complaints. This is what she was saying. And the Labour Party had actually taken advice that if they contested this libel case brought by these former employees, they would win. So why they bailed and paid them off is anybody's guess. I don't know. Shocking stuff. You know how I feel about Israel, and you know how I feel about Jews. I know a few Jews. They're amongst the nicest people I know. They're fabulous. They're great. They're like me. They take people as they find them. But I don't like the state of Israel, and that's putting it mildly. But I can say that now because I'm an independent content creator in Salford and Manchester. If I'm working somewhere else, I'll have to keep that bloody thing to myself, won't we? We'll be back in a minute after this. This is the BBG, not the BBC. Richie Allen, live from Salford.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
And thanks so much for all your tweets. How are you, Patricia? When will people wake up to the difference between Jewish, the religion, and Zionism, the political movement? When will the world pay attention to the atrocities going on in Palestine right now, says Patricia. Thanks for that, Patricia. Appreciate your tweets, by the way. Steve James tweets, the Conservatives will soon be legislating against laughing, singing and cheering in your own home. I hope not, Steve. He goes on to say, does Steve, they've already done via a propagandised, exaggerated virus in public places. I still can't get my head round. Liverpool, after a gap of 30 years, must be marvellous for their fans. I was 18 in 1993 when United won it for the first time in 26 years. When I was 18, I was thrilled. I cried for 2 hours. To not be in the stadium, it's just mental. For them to be outside, drinking their Stella and their McEwans. I don't know. Mad. These are mad times. Hi to David Stanford. How you doing, David? Crack on Verity Hound. How you doing, Verity Hound? Hi to Patrick. How you doing, Patrick? Hi to Study 3 Hab. Harry Poppins. How you doing, Harry Poppins? I love the names. Mentioned Aaron Phelan already. How you doing, Aaron? Hi to Joe Public as well. Richie Allen is live. I am Richie Allen. Don't refer to yourself in the third person. I was going to say the Richie Allen show was like. Richard Willett, filmmaker, podcast maker, and all-round good guy, will be with me in a few minutes' time. We'll have an extended conversation, me and him, about lots of things. It'll be light-hearted. It'll be serious, too. Do get involved. If there's something you'd like me to put to Richard, or if there's something you'd like to say, all you got to do is tweet it to me. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. In the meantime, here is Tanita Tikaram. Tanita Tikaram. Is that it? I got caught there. I thought that was slightly longer, and I was buying myself some time. There you are. Welcome back to the programme. Richard is standing by. Thank God he's standing by, because I was connected to an old Skype account of his and I couldn't understand why he wasn't answering me. But I have a brain, you see. And I posited to myself, maybe, just maybe, he's opened a new Skype account. And very quickly, I searched and, well, you can guess the rest. Not exactly a gripping story. Let's get Richard on. And while we're getting him on, I'm going to tell you very, very briefly about him. He is the host of the Glitch in the Code podcast, which is available on the Iconic platform. He is an exceptionally gifted filmmaker as well. And we've had him on in the past talking about his films. His most recent film, which came out a few weeks ago, is a film called Primed for Panic, Lockdown 2020. And it's available, and we'll find out where you can watch it. And I've seen bits of it, and I like it. And I like him. Let's welcome back to the programme, Richard Willett. Rick, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good, mate. Can you hear me okay?
You sound great. As a pro, you've got a good mic, so it sounds like you're in the room. Are you going to wear a mask tomorrow going about your business, or are you not going to go about your business, Rick?
I think the second one, to be honest. what can you do? No, probably not go back. I'm booked in for a haircut for tomorrow, and I've just realised they might make me wear a mask. So I look like some sort of small Jesus at the moment. So I want to get that sorted. But if they decide to make me wear a mask, I'll just grow it and tuck it in my shirt for a while, because I'm not wearing one now.
Yeah, fair play to you for giving us an honest answer there. By the way, if anybody ever comes on to this programme again and talks about going for a haircut, it'll be their last appearance on this radio programme. I haven't been to a barber since 2010, that's when it was, in Nottingham, when I had a Friar Tuck job done. Tell me this, you're very experienced, of course, as a filmmaker and a producer. And it occurred to me that in the entertainment business, they use the term industry all the time. So whether it's entertainment, stage and screen, television, it's a very bleak time, Rick, isn't it, for actors, actresses, producers, gaffers, key grips. I could be here all day long. It's looking bleak, man.
It's a really weird time. It's one of the reasons why we did Prime for Panic straight away, because we just wanted to see how it would work in this time when you can't travel, you can't meet up with people, you can't do anything. How you're supposed to get 60 people on a film set to make anything is completely impossible. So the way things are going to be made is going to be completely different. It's going to affect everybody in every single way. Obviously, everything is going to be, people have been pulled apart in every industry and put in spaces, physical blockades, emotional and psychological blockades between people. They're putting in everything they can to separate people. So it's strange. It's really strange. I'm setting up the next film now, and we're looking for three actors to be in some drama scenes. And part of the reason why we're struggling is because people don't know what they're going to be able to do and not do in 3 months' time when we're scheduled to film. So, it's going to take the industry apart completely. And I just watched, I think it was the last Terminator a couple of days ago, and it's a god-awful CGI with Arnie in it. And it's like, this is terrible. They don't need actors, but it just, there's nothing there. There's no soul there. So, synthetic, broken up, separated societies in every way possible. It's a very bizarre time, isn't it, Richie? It's odd.
It's very odd. So production companies are being given guidelines about how to set up rehearsals in the near future, let alone to set up actual shooting days. And those are going to be very difficult for creative people, creative minds to work alongside. You have thousands and thousands of people out of work. They're terrified about their prospects. Theatres are going to the wall. They've been on Sky, they've been on the BBC. And that's just one kind of section of society. And Rick, Richard Willett, Rick, you prefer to be called Rick, don't you, Rick? I think you've
said Rick's good, yeah.
So Rick presents Glitch in the Code, the podcast, which is on Iconic. And his films are really, really worthwhile checking out if you haven't checked them out before. We'll talk about Primed for Panic in a moment now. You see, you've just... So I enjoyed speaking with you the first couple of times we spoke. You've set something off in my head now. I was flicking around for something the other evening to watch on the movie channels, and something came up called Alita Battle Angel. There was nothing else on, and I'm not a big... These days, I'm not so big into the action as I used to be, but I watched it anyway, and the main character was a CGI, obviously, creation. And I just wondered, and I thought back to a film that Pacino made years ago called Simone or Sim 1. Are we going to get to the stage, do you think, Rick, because of everything that's going on, where it'll be cheaper and more convenient for filmmakers to actually have CGI people on screen playing, well, human beings?
Well, they've been doing that for a long, long time. And I think that comes back to the we could go even deeper than that and look at how they're using that. It's a good analogy for an avatar. They're kind of getting rid of as much humanity in anything as possible. So, yeah, it's going to be all on-screen, computerized, and then all you're going to do is provide the voice. Eventually, you won't provide the voice. Eventually, you'll provide nothing other than the initial concept and the idea. So everything is becoming like that. So as we see, like in the Terminator films and the terrible new ones that are coming out, I've seen Alita as well. I watched that a few weeks ago, Battle Angel, and it's all CGI. Yeah. And the funny thing is the message they're giving you is about the danger of technology and the danger of technology taking over whilst using technology taking over an industry. It's a complete thumbs. It's a very weird thing to do, is to try and warn us that technology could take over whilst getting rid of humans from films and art and any way of our life and putting technology in the middle. And then complaining about it. So, well, you're causing the problem here.
Yeah.
So it's bizarre, isn't it? So, yeah, without a doubt, that will be. Unfortunately, I'm terrible at CGI and I haven't got the patience to sit there and make a character.
Well, I hope you never do, Rick. I hope you never do, mate, especially because of what you're into. I mean, you're into independent media and exploring alternative versions of events. That's really important. I could speak to you all night about this. Final thing I would say on this, I know nothing about technology. And I don't want to sound really old-fashioned now, but I did see The Neverending Story again the other morning. It was last Saturday morning or the previous Saturday. Caroline was in bed. I'd walked the dogs, came back early, and it was on. And beautiful, wonderful. And because when the effects became available, CGI and all that, first of all, we were wowed by it. We were thrilled by it. It was amazing. But then it got, I think it came to, I don't know if it reached a conclusion or if it reached a kind of a full stop point, because I agree with you now. You look at the stuff now, it doesn't look great. But now you look back on stuff that maybe if I'd have watched Neverending Story 10 years ago, I might have thought 10 years ago it looks dated and out of fashion. Now I looked at it and the amazing sets, even the Goonies, the sets that were made by hand. And I look at it, Rick, and I think, that's beautiful, that's a thing of art. That's something that's just spectacular. Do you know what I mean by that? I don't want to sound all arty now, because I'm not, but the old stuff now just looks beautiful, I think.
Yeah, there was an art to it. They put their heart and soul into these things, and they took time to learn a craft, as you know, working in the alternative media at the moment, but obviously in the mainstream media, you had more time to work on your art and your craft, then everything wasn't served up so quickly. So you would learn things, and also you change as a human being as you learn and you made mistakes. Now everything is so quick, you don't get time to even create a person out of yourself to put into the art. Yeah. So it's all, you look back on these films and they're great. And funny you should say about CGI, when films first come out, and one of the first things I learned when I was doing my degree in film was that the first films come out were trick films. So basically people used to go to the cinema to watch a train on the screen purely to watch the picture on the screen to think. So it was just the entertainment of being able to see something on a screen. There was no story, no narrative. It's like, oh my God, they've filmed something and now it's on the screen. We've gone back to that now. So all you're watching now is the entertainment value of, wow, look at that effect, for pointless reasons. I think it's Gemini with Will Smith, and they recreate him as he's younger. The story is pretty poor.
Oh, it's rubbish.
But it's the fact that they've made him look really young, and that's amazing. It's a trick film. There's no heart and soul in it. So these things go secular, don't they? We do the same things over and over. So we're back to the point now where it's all trickery and it's all illusion again, and the art is dissipated into the background.
Yeah,
and
storytelling is not important or as important as it used to be, and it's difficult now to find a drama, something that you get your heart and soul into and that moves you. The last thing I can remember is we went to see the film Sideways with Thomas Hayden Church and Paul Giamatti when it came out back in 2000. It remains for me the best film I've ever seen in my life. and the oft-mentioned future misses, some that moves you to tears, that changes your perspective on things. We don't see those anymore. Richard Willett is our guest. Great to have Rick back on the programme. Let's talk then about your latest film, Primed for Panic. I've seen little bits of it, Rick. It's very impressive, as usual. Tell us about the motivation to make the film. Obviously, it's centred around this paradigm we're in now. Was there a catalyst? Was there one moment that got you motivated to say, right, I've got to do something here, and I've got to put something down?
Yes, it's the old age of capturing it, capturing the moment in the bottle. I was actually in Derby with Jamie and Gareth Icke at the time. We were filming with a chap called Richard Grant on a series. And the lockdown kicked in as I was in Derby. I was in a hotel there. And I was like, we just got to film it. Just document it. Documentaries that you tend to see now seem to be biographies or biopics or telling you about a scenario that happened a long time ago. But very rarely do you get a documentary now that captures a moment. So I wanted to make a film that when we look back in 20 years' time, we'll go, oh my God, that was happening at the time we were filming it. So literally, as you see the interviews pop up and the people that I'm talking to on and the researchers that are in the film, like Max Egan, Simon Dolan's in the film, David Icke's obviously in the film. I've got Richard Grannan's another chap in the film, and learns a lot of psychology. A guy called Wayne McCroy talks about the technology that's going to be rolling out of the back. We're all actually going through this at the time of the early stages of the lockdown. So it's filmed from March till the end of, I think, May. Around about that time. So it was about 2 months there where we were doing Skype calls and we were filming out and about, and they were sending me footage. And I wanted it to be a encapsulation of the actual time of people, especially people who know where this is possibly going, have very strong theories and done a lot of research to where this could be leading, and their natural reactions to seeing it played out. As you know, Richard, you've been doing this work for many, many years now. We knew this was coming, but we didn't think we'd either live to see it, or we just didn't. When it happens, it's completely different, as it still takes your breath away. So I wanted to document what was happening to people that knew it was coming anyway and still see our reactions to it, and also kind of heads up where this is going. So it's a film that really captures a moment of when this actually kicked in and the reactions of people as it's happening at the early stages, and then shows you where it could possibly go in the next, well, probably in the next 10 years. We're going to be living in a completely different world, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's funny you say, you know, people knew something was coming but didn't imagine this year, and maybe didn't imagine it coming in this form. I suppose I'd be in that group of people. I knew things were going to get progressively more difficult, but I never expected them to say in March, listen, we're going to close down the country because of a virus. It absolutely caught me By surprise, completely unaware. And and what are we now, 3.5-4 months into it now, and there's I suppose in the last few weeks, to some extent, people think that it's become a bit better. They're able to go out, but you know, they're able to go to pubs but under certain conditions. They're able to go to libraries but under certain conditions. And you think, I mean, you just said it yourself there, Rick, you think that this is not something that's going to just stop. You think that this is going to carry on in some shape or form over the next few years, like that there won't be any return to pre-March conditions. You don't see that?
No, not at all. I really don't. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I really do. But no, not at all. This is what we're seeing now is a psychological abuse. It's narcissistic and psychopathic abuse on a global level. So what we're seeing now is that they're kind of rolling back to roll forward. The things that we're accepting now, we would never have accepted a year ago. So the things that we will accept in 10 years, we will never even dream of accepting now. This is how it works. I think it's called the Overton window. So they gradually change the new, and they keep using it, new normal. I've heard it on the TV again today, actually.
Constantly,
I have to turn the TV off. So they create this. So it's an abusive process. So they're getting you used to giving your rights away and seeing them as privileges. So no, it will never go back. Yes, we wanted change, but we wanted it to progress, not regress. So no, I don't see it going back to anywhere near. It will change. We all know this is heading towards the vaccine. We all know that's where it's heading. It's always heading towards the vaccine, and your life is going to shrink down to smaller parts if you don't have the vaccine. Now, what can come good out of that, in my opinion, is it will make you realize what you do and you don't need, and what you really feel is important. And that could be a good thing here in the sense of understanding what's important to you, because we've lived in excess and done stuff we don't really need to be doing for a long while. But no, it's clear, isn't it? They're changing the rules every week, doing it on purpose. These people know full well what they're doing. I don't really buy into, yes, they're buffoons, they're idiots, they're useful idiots in the government. But we all know that they're being funded from the top, from the banking cartels and the banking families. And we all know this has been in place for possibly over 100 years. So we know that this is only a stepping stone and a push towards pushing the overturn window along. And that's why it goes back and forth and back and forth. That's what a narcissistic abusive relationship does. They gaslight you. You do something. They tell you you're bad. It's your fault. You get up again. They give you a hug. They put you back down again. They keep you in your place. Once, if you're always reacting to them, they're going to carry on pushing and pushing and pushing. I liken it to being watching a terrible play, an awful play. If the audience stay in the seats in the auditorium and keep paying their money, the awful play will carry on. They'll bring in new characters off and out and off and in, but the play will still be just as terrible. And you'll always sit in the audience. We'll all be sitting in the audience going, this is god awful, because we're watching and we're giving them our time and attention. And our time and attention is what they're harvesting. They do it for the internet. They do it through Sky TV and all the mainstream media. They want your time and attention. So no, as long as they've got our time and our attention and our acquiescence on a larger scale, if the numbers are tilted in their favor, then no, we know, I think, where this is heading. It's towards the totalitarian system, really.
The inevitable vaccine. And yeah, speaking of thespians, Jean Anne's been on to say, taking away your natural human rights and handing them back as privileges to be earned. She says it's a brilliant psyop and it's working a treat. Rick, as a successful, charismatic and working filmmaker, what is it going to mean for you if sometime in 2021 you are told that there are places you cannot go unless you are able to show that you're immunised? These are not, you know, wind-up questions now or questions to put you off, because I think we're all going to have to face these questions. I'm somebody who loves going to public places. I love going to auditoriums for a bit of music. It doesn't matter what it is. Live music, love it. Love the cinema. And I know there's going to be a time when I'm going to be told, Richie, and it's very important for me because I live and work at home, and and I know you do a lot of that as well, Rick. I know you're out and about because you're a filmmaker, you're a director, a producer, so you get to go on location all the time. But you do a lot of work in your editing suite at home, so you know what it's like. I have to get out. I have to get out of this place. Mm. I said to Caroline today, we're going to a park on Saturday with the two dogs. We haven't done it for months. I can't stand the sight of the house anymore. We've got to do it. In 2021, they say, well, I'm sorry now, Mr. Willett, can't access these places. Can you even imagine, can you contemplate even saying, ah, go on then, I'll roll my sleeve up just for the hell of it, go on. I mean, would that be something that you might see yourself considering?
No, absolutely not. For two reasons. Work-wise, as a documentary filmmaker, it's fantastic because you're just documenting life. Yeah. So as long as life's happening, I'll just document it and tell you what's happening. So that's not a massive deal to me. It doesn't worry me. I'll just tell you, okay, this is happening. The more bizarre things they do, the more material I have to work with.
Yeah.
So that's fine. That doesn't bother me so much. I don't need to leave the country to tell you, to get a message across. The stories are the same wherever you are around the Western world at the moment. So I don't need to go to a different country. We can also hire out camera crews there and send footage back and forth. Personally, I live right near the seafront. So I live in a small town near the seafront on the east of England, and I'll walk down there with the dogs. My partner, we've just had a new little baby.
Oh, you've had a baby. And, I forgot to mention, yeah. Rick, congratulations, mate. It was in my notes. It was in my bloody notes. I should have said it at the beginning. So your life is mental now anyway, right? Crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah, sorry. It's absolutely mental, but mental in a good way.
Yeah.
It's nothing like having a little one to focus you, is there? So yeah. Right now, I'm quite happy with my life here. I mean, I can walk down to the seafront from here. It really disturbs me that you can't go to the shops without a mask on. That is bizarre. And I had to go out today to get my partner's medication today because knowing tomorrow I'd have to walk in and they would try and make me wear a mask. So I'm avoiding confrontations that I should never, ever have to avoid.
Yeah.
This is psychological abuse.
But you're boxing clever, maybe. Yeah. Maybe we're men, and because we're men, we have testicles. And because we have testicles, we have testosterone. And we don't like avoiding confrontations sometimes. We want to stick it to them. I mean, I'm going to Tesco tomorrow. I can't. Now, I'm going to Tesco having been told that Tesco are not going to challenge me. But I'm kind of hoping somebody does, to be honest. Because I am a big curmudgeonly bollocks. I'm sure Gareth Icke and Jamie Icke told you that, and they'd be right. So I'll go looking for an argument. But I think you're right, you're boxing clever. You've got a baby. You've got a family. Sometimes it's a very Don Corleone thing, actually. Sometimes the smart thing to do is to say nothing.
Well, it's that's in me to go there, and there will come a time where I think we'll all kick off. There will be. I see it as a numbers game at the moment. You've got the government there on one side, the British government, that are only really, really just a machine for the global, what I call the global corporation, to use. They're branch managers. I see each government as a branch manager of this global corporation. Then in the middle, you've got the, as we're calling them, the Karens there, that are basically forming a wedge, a door wedge in there, for keeping really the other, say, 40% of the UK population that really do want to push back about this in their place. So we need to tip the level over from that little gap in there. They're very cleverly using people and people's rights as a human shield. So you've got that gap in there that you're not actually bothered about going out to get told off by the government or the police. You're bothered about getting harassed by some Wally. That's what you're bothered about. And that's very, very clever, setting people off against each other. It's that little wedge in there of people policing themselves that is really going to be the issue. And then it comes back to individual sovereignty individual sovereignty. How much are you going to take? How much are you going to take? Are you going to put around you? My idea is you protect yourself by building walls around you. You don't protect yourself by building walls around other people to keep them in their place. So if they want to go off and do these things, fair enough. But you're going to have to go, okay, these are my boundaries, my emotional boundaries. I'm not going to take that. And this shouldn't even be happening. We shouldn't even have to be having these conversations. This is the mass manipulation that they're putting us under as a collective. And we pay their wages. It's unbelievable.
Let me just say this, Rick. Loads of tweets, mate. Unsurprisingly, loads and loads and loads of tweets. This is from Jason. Very good. Jason says, what Rick is referring to regarding gaslighting, praise, punishment, results in a state known as learned helplessness, developed by a guy called Martin Seligman. Thanks so much for that, Jason. Patricia makes reference to the boiling frog thing. If you put a frog into boiling water, it'll jump out. But if the frog is put in tepid water, brought to a boil slowly, it won't perceive it, basically. It won't know what's going on. And that's the situation that most of us find ourselves in at the moment. The filmmaker and journalist Richard Willett is live on the programme. Check out Glitch in the Code on Iconic, the platform Iconic. Go to iconic.com if you want to find out more about that. And check out his films. We're talking, of course, about his most recent film, which is called Primed for Panic. We'll do this at the end again, Rick, but just do it now. Where do people go and get a look at Primed for Panic?
Yeah, you can get it in a couple of places. You can buy or rent it on Vimeo On Demand. So you just put Prime for Panic Lockdown 2020 in there. You can find a few of my films on there. Or you can go over to iconic.com and find it there. And you can get a 7-day free trial, so you can watch it there as well. And if you like what you see, we've got some fantastic content going up there. You can find the film in the catalogue there as well.
Really good. I was talking to a friend of mine this morning. Was out and about with the dogs, and he was saying that he notices amongst his own friends, one or two of them, and he notices amongst his own parents that like a real melancholy has kind of set in in recent weeks. And he says, I wonder how much of that is how common is that? And then he said he saw a report on one of the news programmes, which he ordinarily wouldn't pay too much attention to, but it was an honest report that talked about how this is affecting people psychologically. It's making people very down, and it has resulted in many people turning to stimulants in order to alleviate the depression, the fear, the anxiety. Because, of course, Rick, this is not just about boredom, people being stuck at home. This has put people into a state of real fear about their futures, their financial futures, and, of course, the futures of their children. And, of course, you being a dad, you'll know all about that. I mean, I imagine parents are wondering, what will be there for our children in 18 years' time, 20 years' time? That's a big thing, that, isn't it? And that brings me back to what I wanted to just briefly talk about, was the government's own acknowledgement the other day that at least 200,000 deaths will occur, have occurred, will occur as a result of the lockdown, not because people were in any way sick. And I find that so annoying, because when I talk to people, I generally try to be jovial. And I say to them, right, put your weapons down. Let's pretend I'm in Egypt. Let's pretend you're in Egypt. And we won't argue. Let's just look at the hard numbers. Are you telling me, even if 50,000 deaths is true, that that's better than 200,000? Or 200,000 is somehow not as bad as 50,000. And they just look at you kind of glassy-eyed. The real health impacts of this going ahead, I reckon, Rick, we haven't even scratched the surface yet. It's looking bad, mate.
I agree with you. What we're kind of describing there is something, I know I might be wrong, but I think it's called the Fetcher split. So you're doing something you know is detrimental to yourself, but you're doing it anyway. So you're getting this feeling of helplessness, but also this feeling of anger and this feeling of frustration is all adding up to a massive amount of depression and anxiety. But mostly it's this feeling of your self-worth is completely just destroyed, because you know what you're doing is actually detrimental to yourself, and you know it's wrong and you're doing it anyway. So what happens to your self-worth? And this is what I'm talking about with sovereignty. You need to, people need to individually say, no, these are my boundaries. No, I don't care who you think you are, if you're the prime minister. I really don't care. What have you done to prove to me that you're trustworthy to me as an individual? I don't know you. You clearly haven't done a real job in your life. You've clearly been mollycoddled all your life. You haven't earned my trust. Yeah. And then you start to have these questions in your head, and it's called emotional literacy. Ask these questions and go, look, these people haven't earned your trust, the British public. They haven't earned your trust. They haven't earned the trust for you to hand over your kids' welfare to them. They don't owe you, don't owe them anything. They haven't earned the right to tell you what to do. And then you start to feel power and powerful. And nah, no, I'm not having it. Not having it. No. And then when you start to say no, the power within you starts to heal you. And that sounds really arty-farty. But you go, no. And great, no is such a powerful thing. When you start saying yes to things you know you should be saying no to, you become ill, very emotionally ill. And you start to get probably flu-like symptoms. You probably get depression. You probably start to lose weight. You probably start to eat wrong. You start to drink too much. You start to do all these things you don't do because you're sad.
Because it's a form of bondage. Because you're acquiescing to something you know is profoundly bad for you. But you're doing it because maybe everybody else is doing it. Maybe there's that pressure on you. You feel that external pressure and you go along with it. I never considered that, Rick, but it makes sense to me that it could make you ill, you know, having to do that. That comes under, it's not exactly gaslighting, but it comes under the whole, you know, table of gaslighting, doesn't it? People being told you are something or you have to do something, and you know deep down that it's totally wrong, but you're bombarded with it. And eventually, you know, it's like the abuser, you know, who physically or sexually abuses his wife and keeps telling her, you know, it's your own fault. It's not my fault, it's your fault. Eventually, you know, a lot of victims are like, well, maybe it is my fault. Maybe it is. Yeah. And that's working, I think, for the government or whomever is controlling this through the government. It is working. I see it. I see it. I see the anger, Rick. A guy standing in the park the other morning with a group of dogs. Guy runs past, a young lad, and screams, did you ever hear of fucking Leeds? And runs off. Tough guy. Like, full of rage. In a supermarket the other day, again, patiently waiting for a guy to get away from the crackers so I could get a box of crackers. Guy's masked up to the bloody tits. And eventually he looks at me and goes, can I help you? I'm like, mate, no, you just carry on. I'll wait. And, oh, you're a bit close, aren't you? And I don't blame these people, Rick. I don't blame them. They're being driven to this.
Absolutely. you've been gaslit into this. You're being emotionally abused. You're being, it's triangulating, I think it's called. And not, and anyone listening, I'm not a psychologist at all. I've just looked a lot into this stuff during filmmaking. So I think it's called triangulating. The government and all
that. Say that again. Sorry, Rick. I want to write that down so I can look it up later on. Not to prove you wrong, but just to, but just to look into it. What did you call it again?
I think it's called triangulating. So what it's doing is getting, it's a little bit like the bully in the classroom goes along and he whispers to, say, Karen, and goes, Karen, someone, Johnny said this about you. And he goes over to Johnny and says, Johnny, Karen said this about you. And then just watches the mayhem. And that's basically what I believe triangulating is, right, in a very broad term. I could be wrong, but either way, it's emotional abuse if I've got the term wrong. That's what's happened. The government and the ones funding the governments and the banking families, banking cartels, and if you want to go even deeper than that, wherever it goes up to, they are watching the play out of their own anger and carnage. And they're getting two toys from either side and getting people and smashing them together because they know that's how they break things. They break things by setting them against each other, divide and conquer, divide and rule. So triangulating is basically what's happening in there. Is he knows that what he's doing is probably deep down his core wrong, and he's upset and he's frightened. Of course he's going to be. You're upset and you're frightened. And Actually, neither of you are the abuser. The abuser is the one that's putting this nonsense in place at the very top. Really what needs to happen is little Johnny and little Karen need to turn around and tell the abuser to sod off.
Yeah.
That's what needs to happen. That's the only way, in my opinion, and I'm only a 40-year-old man, I don't know everything. The only way I can see out of this is if you turn around to your abuser and you either do two things. You go grey rock, which means you ignore them, or you give them the bare minimum of what you need to speak to them. Grey rock is just ignore them. These people in governments and in parliaments, they are not there to be looked upon. We're brainwashed into thinking they're above us. They're not. They're below us. They're acting as if they're below us. These are a global corporation. If someone from Argos told you what to do, why would you do it?
These are not.
I mean, it's ridiculous. These work for a global corporation. We know that. We know that behind each government party, behind the governments, behind the parties, behind the politicians, corporations.
Rick, we are conditioned. Let me tell you a very funny quick story. Richard Willett is our guest, Glitch in the Code podcast iconic, and he's a really, really, really talented filmmaker. And his latest film, we've just been talking about it. I'm going to put links out, by the way, those links that Rick mentioned earlier on, Primed for Panic. I'll put links out to where you can go and watch it. I never forget the first time we lived in Manchester before we moved to Spain. You two, don't shout at me, Rick. Don't shout at me. You two were at the Etihad, Man City Stadium, and I used to be so diehard. I would get panic attacks on live concert day. I would get panic attacks because I wanted to be at the barrier up the front. So God love her indoors. God, amazing woman. Not as enamoured by you two as me. She got up at the crack of dawn anyway, and we made our way down to the Etihad. And as luck would have it, there was a few people there before us, and we bought these special tickets anyway to get us onto the pitch. Long story short, anyway, I tell you how people are sheep. And even then, I was kind of half a sheep myself. This girl started walking along the line with a marker, and she started numbering people's hands, saying, "When things get a bit crazy later on, I'm going to put a number on everybody's hands so that we'll all know who was here first in what order." And this woman had no authority, Rick. She was, God love her, a heavyset, matronly type woman who was a U2 fan. She was just there like the rest of us. But every fucking idiot in the queue, including me, stuck me hand out. And she put a number on me hand. And there's only the future Mrs. Allen said, "Who the fuck is she?" And I said, but everybody did it. And I thought, we are useless, aren't we? We don't question anything. What we should have said was, piss off, love. When they open the gates, it's going to be a stampede. It's going to be like the Pamplona Bulls. You know that. I know that. But no, we took the numbers on our hands, Rick. We're doomed. Exactly. We're doomed, Rick.
Yep. Yep. And this is the case, isn't it? We're all watching them.
Yeah.
And they, like a narcissist, like a great, someone who wants your attention. If you give them your attention, they'll do anything with your attention. You're giving them your time and attention. All we really need to do in decent amount of numbers is take our time and attention away from these people and go about normal. That's all we need to do.
You're talking civil disobedience here, right? This is my greatest dream. It's my greatest wet dream is civil disobedience. Is that my neighbours will say, yeah, we're going to disenfranchise ourselves. We're not compliant anymore. They can stick their council tax where the sun doesn't shine. We'll make our own waste management arrangements with somebody else. We'll get a good deal and they can piss off. Do you know what? I pray for the day, Rick.
And that's what they're terrified of, because like a virus needs a host, and we're their host. And if they don't have us, they can't live. And this is their dichotomy, is that they need us as much as they hate us, and therefore they hate us because they need us. And that's the problem that these elites have, is that we're needed.
And they need us now, Rick. They need us now. But I know that you are prepared, or you have looked at the notion of Agenda 21, Agenda 30, the global reset, the plan, which ultimately leads to the removal of large swathes of human beings, maybe several billion. They need us for the moment, for sure. You go along with the notion, don't you, that ultimately, while parasiting off us for now, in the near future, they want a lot of us to be gone.
Absolutely. I mean, that's as clear as day. It's on the Georgia Guidestones. It's been written about. I mean, how obviously the Nazis were done horrific things to do with it. Jim Mars has wrote about the Fourth Reich, that the Nazis never went away. And I can believe that from the start. They're still here now. You don't now have to look at the Planned Parenthood and the people involved in that and the vaccines that are coming out now. Yes, they want to take the population down. There's too many people in the theatre audience and they're terrified of a stampede. Of course they are. So, yeah, they want to take us down and take the numbers down and to a more manageable numbers. So, yes, they need us in that sense. And then it goes even deeper to that, to looking into AI and do they need our creativity? Because I believe that these people at the very core of this aren't creative. They can't come up with their own concepts and their ideas. Therefore, they do need a certain amount of people to make the plans and the vision, the agenda happen. But, yes, of course, they want to take us. Take the numbers down. I think it was 500 million on the Georgia Guidestones?
Yeah, that's what it says, yeah. 500 million. So that would be, my mathematics is terrible, that's about 90%+ of everybody else gone. Around about that, I reckon. Or 85%. Yeah, and I reluctantly came to believe that as well. Reluctantly, not because I was worried about what anybody would think about me for saying it, but reluctantly because I didn't want to countenance it. I didn't want to consider it. Imagine it, Rick. I mean, you're a very smart lad. You are. I'm not patronising. You're 40. You're very, very bright. You're very articulate. It shines out in your work. And at some stage, you must have had to say to yourself, holy shit, like, this is going on. At some stage, you have to admit it. And that's very difficult. It's like admitting you're an alcoholic in some ways. I mean, I'm not an alcoholic. I drink too heavily sometimes. I can only imagine, you know, when you have to accept it. It's not easy to accept this, that this is where it's going. And of course, that's one of their great... It's one of their great trump cards, isn't it? The incredulity. How many times have you said to people over the years, you've done a brilliant bit of filming, you've interviewed somebody who's an academic, you've interviewed somebody who's got, you know, a bit of weight, a bit of meat behind what it is they're saying. And the person you're speaking to looks at you like you've got 15 heads. Incredulity, right? People, it's like, ah, no way, Rick, come on. And that's another thing that I find hard to get through. You know, it's like... Just before you come back in, just very briefly, it's like Harry Vox came on this show a few weeks ago to talk about his video from 2014 when he saw the Rockefeller document. And for our listeners who don't know, the Rockefeller document in 2010, the foundation think tank, basically imagined this very scenario that we're in now and proposed the exact same lockdown measures as we're in now. And also in the document recommends that governments keep these measures. Now, you can go and show that to people. It's hard evidence. And they'll go, ah, come on, you know. What do you do, Rich? Yeah. What do you do?
Well, no, I mean, that was lockstep, wasn't it? And yeah, lockstep came out. And I've had this conversation with people as well. And they're going, nah. And I said, well, at the very core, at the very least, just in terms of lockstep, these people are willing to see you as something to be played with.
Yeah.
Does that not give you an understanding of the psychology and the psychopathy of these people? And someone said to me once, is that anyone who would want to be in charge of a country who would want that job would have to be a psychopath.
Imagine.
Because that's a horrible bloody job. I don't want to bloody deal with that. Why would I want that much? One, control over people. Two, that responsibility. That's a psychopath's job. That is built for psychopathy. So these people are psychopaths. And when it comes down to things like the vaccines, I'm not anti-vax. What I am, is I'm anti the people funding the vaccines. I said this before recently to someone. I said, I'm not anti darts, but I wouldn't stand anywhere near Bill Gates during a game of darts if he was throwing the dart. Do you know what I mean? It's the person with the dart is the problem.
Yeah.
So look to who's funding these things. Don't worry about, you're not anti-vax just because of that. I'm anti-vaccine because Bill Gates has got in his hands and his dad was part of Planned Parenthood. And Microsoft was funded by IBM. IBM helped fund some of the tech for the Nazis. It's not rocket science in that way.
Why did they choose him?
Was rocket science.
Here's the question for you now, and this is pure opinion, obviously. He's the front man for depopulation. He's the front man for mass vaccination. He's the front man for implanted technology. Although Elon Musk might say, you know, I'm there as well. He's detestable, and he was detestable when he was... We remember those antitrust lawsuits that he was involved in Microsoft all those years ago. He is a detestable, awful, squirrely, horrible fucking man. He's horrible to listen to, right? Why didn't they choose somebody like, I don't know, Oprah? Or somebody cuddly, you know, somebody nice that you might say might be more amenable to people, that you might listen to more. I don't know why they chose him, because he is truly dreadful.
I think it was simply because his mum was very close to some very powerful people, and they had their son wanted it at a pet project, and he was quite good with computers. And they thought, well, the fourth industrial revolution is going to be all around this technology and his computers. We need to get his PCs in every home. And how bad are PCs? I mean, Christ, he couldn't even fix them properly.
Yeah.
And even then, he stole half of the Intel chip, I believe. That was not his idea. Some of that come from somewhere else. Part of it was taken from somewhere else. So it was, I think he was just like, he was easy to push around. He was a bit of a, do you notice how they're all geeky and they're all a bit odd?
Yeah.
They're all a bit geeky and easy to push around. And they're all the sort of person that probably wouldn't really do very well with the ladies at school. So they're probably given like, okay, if you get this, you'll become Iron Man, basically. And they've gone for it. And I think that's probably it. Right place, right time. It could have been any other geek. Elon Musk was a complete geek. When you watch the early videos of him, he had no hair. So suddenly he's grown hair, which is amazing. And he was about 6 stone lighter. And he was walking around with some Hollywood blonde with a kind of a DeLorean car. This was about 15 years ago before he really blew up. So they had money behind this guy a long time ago. So they pick them. They pick the disfranchised. They pick the outcast and bring them in and then use them.
Let me ask you a quick question. By the way, Advanced Hair Studio, Shane Warne, that's probably where Elon Musk went. He's got the money. I don't have the money for that. A friend of mine said, Richie, if you won the lottery, tell the truth, Rich, you'd have a hair transplant. Of course I wouldn't. I'm proud of myself. Listen, let me ask you this. That Elon Musk video from a couple of weeks back, I'm asking a genuine expert here. Richard Willett is live on the Richie Allen Radio Show, filmmaker extraordinaire and the host of the Glitch in the Code podcast on Iconic. Was that a mouse running across the screen, or was that just somebody messing with us to try and make us all look like a bunch of idiots? You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
Well, I haven't actually seen that one. A mouse. Let me just go have a look.
Go on for the crack. You'll find it live.
What, on the Falcon?
Yeah, this is it. The thing was in space, and obviously there's a camera on it, so you could see it in space. And it looked like a mouse was scurrying across the wing or something. And I'm sure the mouse didn't have a spacesuit. It looked like a mouse, right? So people jumped on this and said, yet again, this is fake. But I thought to myself, if I was Elon Musk and I had a sense of humour, I would put that out there just to annoy people. I don't know if you'll bring it up now, if you'll be able to see it. But while
I'm just having a look now. But I mean, I think that either way, yeah, it could have been either. I mean, we know that the 2001 A Space Odyssey was probably a bit of a dry run for Kubrick. We know that he was involved with what they were doing at NASA.
Can I jump in? Vivian Kubrick. I hate to drop names, Rick. In fact, I can't, because I don't know too many well-known people. But I know Vivian well, and I had quite a few phone calls with Vivian. And I know she might be listening to this. Wonderful woman, very active in the independent media, in sharing people. I put it to Vivian about Stanley doing the moon landings. And she said, as far as I know, Richie, no way, nothing to do with it. Mm. And I said, what about all these clues then, the films and all that? And she said, well, look, you know, people look at these things, they draw conclusions. But she said, as far as I'm concerned, he didn't. So I'm just putting that out there. I laughed, of course. I went, go on, tell me. I'll never tell anybody, Vivian. I'll never tell anybody if you tell me. I'd have been straight
Yeah, we
up.
Don't know, do we? We don't know. And I think at the end of the day, really, I think what NASA were actually doing, the more important things was the funneling of the Nazi scientists in and out, and what they were possibly doing underneath was more interesting than what they were doing on top.
Absolutely right. As an expert in films, I know we segued, we're jumping around, but you know what, mate, it's the end of the week and you've cheered me up, Rick. You really have, mate, and you've cheered my audience up as well, having you on. It's dire stuff, this, but it's great to be able to laugh as well. Listen, you know all about films. The actual Apollo 11 footage that they gave us, Armstrong and all that, do you doubt the authenticity of that footage?
Yeah, only because of who's showing it to you, not because of the footage. Again, it comes back to the same thing with the vaccines.
Yeah,
only because it's been put out by people you can't trust. It's as simple as that. It's not really. It's like reading a book about someone. The information of this book might be amazing, but then you just have to look at the author and whether you trust them or not to deliver. Do you know what I mean? So it's like you could give someone a broom in your garden, and if you don't trust them and you don't know them, they might hit you over the head of it, or they might sweep the curb. It really depends. So I don't trust it because of where it comes from, but not because it looks any different. And also, we know that the US didn't have a space program until after the Second World War. Yeah. So we know that for starters. What a weird world we live in, really. Strange world.
Most of them, I mean, I you mentioned David earlier on, and I obviously spent a lot of time with him in London, and many an evening talking about these things. And I remember chatting with him, and a mutual friend actually came over to have a bit of dinner and have a drink. And we were sitting there, a couple of glasses of wine were consumed, so everybody was relaxed. And I think it was the friend who actually said, I now doubt absolutely everything. I doubt the table in front of me. I doubt the glass that is holding the wine. I just don't know what is going on. You know, things are so strange. And I feel a bit like that now, you know. It's not a depressing way to feel. It's wondrous at times. Other times it is a little bit scary. But I'm really looking forward to seeing what's coming next. Now, that's a strange... I said that to a friend of mine, and he said, I'm really worried, Richie. And I said, I am as well, but I want to see where this goes. I want to be around for a few more years just to see what they'll try, what they'll do, to the point where, you know, will it eventually inspire some sort of a revolution? You know, a peaceful, non-violent one. Do you find yourself thinking like that, Rick? You know, you start to question every bloody thing you see around you. And is that something that you have to keep an eye on?
Yeah, I do. I do question everything. I've always been like that. I was a very ill child, so I'd always spent my time looking at the world completely different from the outside in. But yeah, I think that's a great way to be. I think it was Bruce Lee that said, be like water. So you kind of just watch things go by. The less you try and hold on to things, I think, in life, the easier it gets, because everything does change and everything moves on. And if you're not attached to the whole, and it's not easy to do this. I don't do this all the time. I barely do it at all. But it's kind of like, okay, this is happening, but we know we go somewhere else afterwards, and we came from somewhere else. Yeah. And I think that's perhaps having some sort of life philosophy that doesn't just exist within this world gives you a real good a feeling of comfort of that actually we're only here for a brief amount of time. What are you going to do with this time? How are you going to make your mark on the world? How are you going to contribute? Because you bring nothing in other than your creative ideas. You leave them here, your creative concepts. You try and fix a few things, and then you sod off to the next room. So you might as well try and like kind of play the game a bit, because what's the point in stressing yourself out about all this stuff? And as you say, from someone who looks into conspiracy theories all the time, it's very easy to start find yourself in the corner staring at the wall, licking the floor, isn't it, and going, I don't know what's going on, because these are all theories, and they're no more, they don't exist any more in my head than they do in the real world. I've never seen them. I don't know if they're true or not, but you try and find a way of trying to kind of add up value points to see whether they would actually be true or not, and then you'd make your judgment on that. So you need some sort of understanding of where you are and what your purpose is, and once you do, you kind of do see it as a journey, as Bill Hicks said, it's just a ride, and That really helps if you just see it as a ride. And that's not, doesn't mean you don't care. It means you just, it's a bit more enjoyable because you know you take nothing with you anyway. So,
and that might change the energy around you. It might exactly. make a more positive energy around you. Can I ask you this? It was often said to me when I was younger that children who had difficulties or people who had real difficulties with illness when they were children or very young children often had or were believed to have had an ability to sense things or to see things or to know things. You know, maybe like a little bit of, I don't know, second sight or clairvoyancy. Do you ever find yourself like that, Rick?
I kind of have a sense of understanding people without them having to say it. I've always been very, very sensitive, and that's it. And that's why I suppose I like documentary films, because I understand what people are trying to say before the, without them having to say it. And I'm reading people. You become, when you're an ill child, you do become very aware of your surroundings and people because you're in a complete helplessness mode. I was in Great Ormond Street for the first sort of 5 years of my life. So, I was born without an esophagus, a big gap in my esophagus. So I had to get that fixed. And it does give you a completely different outlook. I spent a lot of my time as a kid not being able to go out with the other kids because, sounds such a sob story, but
no,
it does
very
give, because I was ill. And so you watch people and it does give you a completely different look. So on the world, you're an outsider looking in. So that has, if anything, is giving me a completely different outlook on life completely.
Wow, that must have been very difficult on your parents. You've been as ill as that. For our listeners overseas who don't know, Great Ormond Street Hospital is a very famous children's hospital in London, and it's a remarkable place. I visited it one time many years ago, and Rick, as he just said there, was there for the first few years of his life. Thank God you made it, Rick, and I'm really interested that you said yes, that there is a bit of a heightening of the senses, because, again, the older folks, I mean, my grandparents and stories that would have been told, you know, when people weren't glued to TVs and phones, it was believed that youngsters who had a very difficult start in life did have a sensitivity and did have a kind of a sight or a second sight, not saying that they were, you know, clairvoyance. And I think you've kind of confirmed that for me now. It would have been a very difficult time for your parents, undoubtedly. Wow. But you got over it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But you got imagine just having a little boy myself and couldn't imagine what they went through. And it gives you a completely different understanding and respect for your parents of what they go through. I mean, for my parents to go through 5 months of me being in Great Ormond Street must have been horrific. Must have been. And it gives you a completely different respect for your own life. And then you build these boundaries and go, okay, I'm not going to wear a mask. I'm not doing that. I survived all of that stuff. And why am I going to wear a mask to go in Aldi? Don't be stupid. I've got too much self-respect.
Yeah.
Have this self-respect.
But then you get an ad hominem. Then you get a stupid ad hominem attack. Oh, well, screw you, buddy. You don't care about old people. I mean, saying that I'm not going to wear a mask, where did they get or you don't give a shit about old people? But this is where things are now. This is the social media environment, you know, absolutes. As Kevin Meyer said the other night, 240 characters, just rubbish. It's rubbish. No, mate, the last thing in the world I want to do is see old people get ill. But I know from my own research that I'm not going to make any old person unwell or kill them. I'm not. It's basically impossible. So I'm not going to wear your daft mask. I'm going to stick up for my own principles, and that's the way it's going to be. Rick, before we wrap it up today, let me ask you to remind our listeners where they can catch your recent film, but your other films. Primed for Panic, Lockdown 2020 is your current film. I've been looking up to your previous films, which are excellently produced. Let our listeners know where they can watch them, mate, please. And it's been great having you on.
Thank you, mate. Thank you for asking me. I'm always a pleasure, and I'm a massive supporter of your work, as you know. You can go to iconic.com. That's the new alternative media platform. It's like a Netflix for alternative information, basically. And find them there. They've got a 7-day free trial, and then it's a monthly subscription or a yearly subscription. Or you can go to Vimeo and find it there. Just put Prime for Panic Lockdown 2020, and you'll find it there. You can rent and buy it there. I've also got Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, which I shot last year with Jonathan Rawl. I know you've had on the show.
Brilliant film.
It takes you through every little area of manipulation that's happening right now, and shows you how they're using hypnotic tricks and tricks, sleight of hand, to trick you into these things, and it just pulls it apart. And we shot that last year before any of this even happened. Also there's Plugged In, which is about social media and social media addiction with Richard Grant, and he's an incredible guy. So if you want to learn how the minds of these psychopaths work, I would look up Richard Grannan's work on YouTube, and you'll find out how narcissism works and how psychopathy works and how to defend yourself, most importantly, against it, because this is on the macro and the micro scale. It's the same abuse. We're being abused by a psychopathic, sociopathic elite. And I hate that word, because they're not elite, because they're so far down below us that they have to put themselves above us. That will teach you to show you the signs of what's actually happening to you and why you're so confused and upset right now, because we are being abused on a global scale. Nothing I've seen in my life, and nothing that's probably happened since the Second World War, I would assume, in the Western world anyway, at least.
Folks, you can follow Rick on Twitter as well. His Twitter account is @RickInTheWall. Obviously, all one word, @RickInTheWall. He's given you the links to the films. Go to iconic.com, where you will get more info and you will get access to the Glitch and Decode podcast. And there's a lot of other very interesting programs on that platform as well. Have a brilliant weekend, mate. Congrats on the baby again. And that goes to, obviously, your partner as well. Lovely to hear the seagulls in the background. I'm dead jealous, by the way. As somebody who grew up by the sea and lived by the sea in Spain, I'm landlocked now in Salford, but loved hearing the seagulls. Continue making your brilliant films, Rick, and come back anytime you want, mate. That's an open invitation. Thanks for coming on today. Have a brilliant weekend.
Cheers, mate. Thank you. The seagulls are massive here. I'm only 5'4". They're about the same size as me. So it might be good for you, but it's terrifying.
Don't go out with a punnet of chips in your hand. Don't do that. You'll be attacked.
Cheers, buddy.
Cheers, Rick. Lovely guy, Richard Willard. Rick, as we call him, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show for Thursday, July the 23rd of 2020. That's the one, 2020. Lots of comments came in there. Thanks for them. Lovely to hear from you on Twitter. I'm going to read a few of them now, if I can. Tell you what I'll do. I'll take a tune. I was going to just disappear now. I was going to do, I said 90 minutes today, going to go. But I'll take a tune. When I come back, I'll read your comments. And, yeah, all right. Here's KC and the Sunshine Man. I don't know where I pulled this one from, but it's good. It's good. Got your bell bottoms on. And your mirror ball, eh? There's nothing like music to make the memories come flooding back to you, if you think about that. Music, you know, sometimes smells. Sometimes you'll smell something and it'll bring you back someplace. For me, it's music and the things. I mean, I'm 45 now, but the things that I saw, the memories of growing up and becoming a nightclub DJ very young, and the people I met and the mad stories. And I know from experience how great writers like Peter Kay and others like him wrote sitcoms like Phoenix Nights. I could have, if I had the ability to write, you know, write for the screen or write for the stage, which I don't, but if I did, I could have written The Funniest Things. The people I met in my life doing the job that I used to do. I was DJing at a club many years ago. It was in the mid-90s, and I was like 19 or 20, and because it was in the mid-90s, it was a kind of a more upmarket nightclub, or at least it thought it was anyway. And the vast majority of the punters were in their 30s and 40s. So I had to play a lot of 70s music, a lot of 70s music. And I didn't mind that, because I grew up with a tape machine in the house with everything from Irish music, from Irish legends like Joe Dolan, obviously, pop legends Joe Dolan, to traditional Irish music like the Dubliners, the Chieftains, the Furies, just everything, to punk, Neil Diamond, the Bee Gees, everything you think. So I didn't mind. I played the 70s in this nightclub. And there was a guy who used to come into the nightclub, and he was immaculately dressed in a white suit with a black shirt, and he was good looking. Back in the day, you wouldn't say any bloke was good looking, because he'd be roundly abused for saying something like that. But that's the way we were. But the guy was decked out, and he was a good looking lad. And he used to dance on his own on the dance floor. And he had all the moves. It was like he was trained as a disco dancer. If you think Saturday Night Fever, Travolta, but think Airplane and Ted Stryker. The guy had all the moves, the rolling hands, the foot movements, everything. It was comical now, right? But there was never any woman anywhere near him. And I used to wonder about this because he was a good-looking lad. I used to think, what's going on there? He would dance by himself, paying no attention to anybody, on a Thursday evening. And then he would piss off at closing time. And eventually I found out that the guy had a very extreme form of autism, where basically he didn't speak to anybody. Didn't really acknowledge the existence of other people. He was in his 30s. And his family dropped him off to the nightclub. I mean, this is, you couldn't make this stuff up. This is pure small town madness. So they would drop him off, leave him out. He would pay his fiver to come in. He wouldn't have a drink. And he would dance for 2.5 hours, doing all the moves. And then he would go home. Oh, Christ. The stuff, I could fill pages. Just thinking, Mac, and I heard that KC and the Sunshine Band song there, and it just brought me back to that. Finding out, asking, what's the deal with your man? There's never any woman. He's always on his own. He knows the moves. What's going on? Oh, he's got this type of... he's an autistic savant or something. Yeah. Wow. Hi to William Henderson. How you doing, William? Very interested in what Richard Willett had to say. He's a breath of fresh air, says William. Thanks, William. Really appreciate that. We aim to please at Richie Allen Show Towers. Like to get good guests on. Hi to David Stanford again. History is a constant battle between tyranny and freedom. It will never change, tweets David. Thank you, David. I echo that. Steve likes the old KC and the Sunshine Band. Thanks, Steve. Hi to Faisal there as well. Hi to Bob. Hi to Stuart. A lot of interest in a couple of stories today. Shall I remind... I didn't get into this in the monologue because I didn't have any time, but here's an interesting story. I did... I'm pretty sure I put it on Facebook earlier on, and I'm pretty sure I put it on Twitter. It was very early in the day. It's Charles Bremner writing in The Times. I'll read you the entire article, or nearly all of it, right? It's about 5G. French mayors have called for a halt to the construction of 5G mobile masts until, that is, health risks can be assessed. The green mayors of Bordeaux, Nantes, Grenoble and other big cities have joined a revolt against the technology amid fears of dangerous radio waves and damage to the environment. Groups acting for electrosensitive sufferers claim that the transmissions damage health. We know these waves have an impact on our brains and that people are showing electrosensitive symptoms with ever greater suspicions that they cause cancer, said Sophie Pelletier, head of Priortem If Caroline was here now, she could read it. The group is Priortem Electrosensible de France. On, Richie, get in there. Head of Priortem Electrosensible de France. De France. That's an association of people that are concerned about electrosensitive... hypersensitivity, yes, which is real, by the way. Every arsehole that you meet that says it's a figment of the sufferer's imagination, every Luddite who tells you that they're making it up, that it doesn't exist, is lying. I've seen all the hard evidence myself. Some of us are extremely sensitive to this radiation and are electrosensitive. I know this to be true. And they, God love them, they get no recognition for it. But this is very interesting now, because some of these French towns, currently, the mayors are Green Party, and we know what we think of the Green Party, but on this issue, we seem to be in alignment with them. They're asking questions about 5G. Anne Vigneault, the newly elected Green Mayor of the eastern city of Besançon, tweeted, 5G causes problems for public health. Don't rush for technologies that run us into a brick wall. Here's the question. Where the feck are the Greens in the UK? Where are the Greens in the Republic of Ireland? Where are the Greens? This party that's so dev... What about all these Extinction Rebellion arseholes? Those people should be screaming from the rooftops about 5G, but they don't say a thing, do they? But in France, the Green mayors are saying, hang on a second, Pierre Hurmic, H-U-R-M-I-C, the new mayor of Bordeaux, said it was inadmissible to impose 5G without discussion, without finding out the opinion of inhabitants. And the Times goes on to say, Charles Bremner in the Times, while Britain and the US have focused on the potential Chinese spying menace from networks built by Huawei, the new generation technology has triggered a traditional French suspicion that sinister forces are at work behind commercial innovation. About 50 5G masts have been damaged by suspected far-left activists and anarchists, two of whom are arrested and jailed. Some of the hostility is fed by conspiracy theories linking 5G. See, this is bullshit now. This is Charles Bremner. He's written the story in the Times. And in the story so far, he's told us about the mayors. Now he's got to inject his own bullshit into the story. And he's saying some of this hostility is fed by conspiracy theories linking 5G and coronavirus. But serious opposition, or at least caution, is coming from a coalition of left Greens, health campaigners, and even members of the government. A lot of questions on the environment, health, security, and sovereignty are arising, said Senator Hervé Maurey, an ally of Macron, and also a digital specialist. So this Senator Hervé Maurey is a friend of President Emmanuel Macron's, but also a specialist in digital technology. He said, Hervé said, we shouldn't just do any old thing in the name of progress. That's very interesting, of course, and should be of great interest to our listeners and to some of the guests who have come on this programme as well. Coming up for 15 and a half minutes to the top of the year. I might just take my leave of you now. I wanted to read that one out before I left the programme today. Lovely. Deb says, remember, Lloyd's of London call it the next asbestos and won't insure it. And I've heard that, Deb. You might do me a favour, you might put a link out there. Insure the technology. Because insure the companies behind it. Because of fears that mass litigation is a possibility in the near future. When people start getting very, very ill and they go to their doctors and then they go to their lawyers and say, listen, I've been injured by a 5G mast. I demand restitution. But Deb, here's my question. How far gone will we be at that stage? Will it be impossible for people to sue these companies? We hear the term indemnification often mentioned around vaccine manufacturers. What sort of shady backroom deals are being done between those behind 5G and our governments to protect them from litigation in the name of progress? Now, I'm not making, you know, I might be talking through my arse. I often do. But I'd be worried about that. It's not going to be easy, is it? In the near future, maybe, to sue these companies. It might become difficult even. You might know for a fact. You might be absolutely sure that exposure to the technology has made you ill, has rendered you ill or your family. But getting a judge anywhere in the world to accept that might be problematic. And I don't want to be negative or pessimistic, but this is the world we live in. Anyway, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take my leave of you now. It's been a packed old show again. I'm looking forward to the weekend. I hope you are as well. I'll be back with you on Sunday View. I'm no longer imbibing. I had too much to drink last weekend and I'd gotten into the habit of having a couple of drinks after work. It's not good. It ain't me. I'm very fit. I run every day. I'm in great shape. So I've knocked the drinking on the head. So I'll be with you on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock for Sunday View, where we'll have a look through the papers and we'll eavesdrop on the mid-morning talk shows as well. That's Sunday View. In the meantime, you look after yourselves and one another. We'll leave the programme today with the Queen of Soul. That's her. Bye for now. Thanks again to Richard Willett. Thanks, Rick.